Will you pray with me? Good and gracious God, may the words of my mouth, the meditations of all of our hearts, be pleasing and acceptable to you, O Lord. For you alone are our rock and our redeemer. And let all God's people say, Amen. Amen. Well, it was 300 years ago, in 1719, that the composer, Isaac Watts, already famous for many of the hymns that he had written, put together a new collection of hymns based loosely on the words of the Psalms and published it later that year. It was entitled The Psalms of David, Imitating the Language of the New Testament and Applied to the Christian State and Worship. You know, you probably got a copy on your shelf at home. Actually, you don't, because every one of those psalms has long since fallen into obscurity. All of them, except for one of them that was based on the text from Psalm 98, which says in part, "Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Break forth in joyous song. Let the hills sing together for joy at the presence of the Lord, for he is coming to judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with equity." Or, said a little differently in what was then contemporary 18th century English prose, "Joy to the world, the Lord is come, let earth receive her king, let every heart prepare him room, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing." That hymn, too, probably would have fallen into obscurity, but some decades later, it was set to a new tune attributed to George Frideric Handel. Some years later after that, rearranged by Lloyd Mason, and now comes to us as the beloved Christmas carol, of course, Joy to the World. One of the most published Christmas carols, really one of the most published hymns across the world today. And even though it wasn't intended to be a Christmas hymn, we sing it, of course, every year, just like every other church and every other place. And so, in acknowledgement of the 300th anniversary this year, we decided to choose a refrain from the carol to be our Advent and Christmas theme this year, "Heaven and Nature Sing." Though, to be fair, we had looked at a few other possibilities of themes from the carol, and they didn't test out quite as well, like "Welcome to First Presbyterian Church," where our Advent and Christmas theme is "Far as the Curse is Found." Well, that just didn't really have the same ring to it. I'm not quite sure how we would have represented that visually, but anyway, we did settle on "Heaven and Nature Sing." It was an acknowledgement, both of the carol, but we also hoped it would say something important to us about what's going on in our world. This carol clearly has remained popular for a reason, and maybe it's something about the intersection of the text and the tune, the melody and the message. Maybe there's something, even in these fleeting moments of Advent, in this season of longing and yearning, about our yearning for a sense of joy in our lives and even in our world. So I've been giving a lot of thought this season to what are the experiences and expressions of joy that we have in our life and in our world? And is it the same for everyone? Is everyone's experience of joy the same? I was reminded of a story of a colleague. Tom R. is the pastor of Village Presbyterian Church in Kansas City. And one Christmas time several years ago, when Tom's children were still in elementary school, he recalls a night in the middle of the night when he was awoken by noise downstairs. He got up and grabbed his robe. He peeked around the hallway on the second floor, confirming that everybody was in their bed, fast asleep. And he panicked, knowing that there was an intruder in the house. So he grabbed his phone. He dialed 911. 911, what's your emergency? He gave his name and his address and explained that there was an intruder downstairs. She said, "I understand, and help is on its way. Are you able to see anything? Can you tell anything about who might be down there?" And so Tom began to creep down the stairs and look around the corner into the dining room, where there was just enough ambient light coming from the streetlights outside through the blinds that he was finally able to make out the intruder, a hamster named Skippy. It turned out that one of his children had the great joy in their lives of being chosen from among their classmates to bring home the classroom hamster, Skippy, to house sit for the holiday season, and no one had thought to let Dad know. Tom said, "So there I am, looking like an idiot in my dining room, with 911 on the phone, help on the way, all because I'm scared to death of Skippy the hamster who's home for the holidays." Whether or not an experience brings one joy depends on one's perspective, I guess. What was joyful for the children was not for Tom. I've been using that lens of experiences and expressions of joy to reread the familiar Christmas text this year to see if this new lens would help me notice anything differently. The stories, of course, are so familiar to us. We have heard them 100 times if we've heard them once, haven't we? But this year I did notice something just a little bit different. I was reading through the stories in Luke, the last couple stories from Luke chapter 2 that we heard, and I was puzzled that when the angel comes to the shepherds on the hillside, well, understandably, first the shepherd says, "Do not be afraid," because the shepherd clearly has scared the socks off of them by showing up in the middle of the night out in the countryside. But then the angel to the shepherd says something curious. "Behold, I bring you good news of great joy." Good news of great joy. Now, for we who have heard the Christmas story and know how it ends, who know the whole Christian story, we have a sense, don't we, in hindsight, of what the great joy really ends up being all about. But I tried for a moment to put myself in the shoes of those shepherds, or their sandals perhaps, wondering what would have been good news of great joy for them in their lives. After all, we know that shepherds were likely at the very bottom rung of the socioeconomic ladder in their day. They were people who not only lived in poverty, probably tending other people's sheep on other people's land, but because they were engaged in work which was earthy and dirty and smelly, they would have been marginalized even by people of similar social status that they had. What would have been good news of great joy for them? And worse still, all of their people were living under the occupation of fear and dread from the Roman army. The opportunities to have any sense of hope or hopefulness in their lives would have been squashed by so many of the circumstances bearing down around them. What I wonder might have been good news of great joy for them, even as they travel to Bethlehem, even as they find this scene with Mary and Joseph and the baby, they discover not a newborn prince in a palace or in some other seat of power. They discover other ordinary people like them, other people probably similarly living in poverty, themselves far from home, put out of any place to stay for the night, and there with the baby in the feeding trough meant for animals, not for a human child. How would this have given them great hope? How would this have given them great joy? And yet we know that they leave rejoicing, telling others about what they had experienced. And yet I can't help but be curious about what would have been so joyful for them in that experience. Maybe some of us tonight have gathered here, like the shepherds, with our own places in life of longing for and even wondering about whether or not there are experiences of joy to be had. Now, I know most of us are here for reasons both in part of tradition and of faithfulness, but I also wonder if sometimes we come out on Christmas Eve because we too, especially we this year, are seeking an experience of joy in our lives. We don't have to turn on and watch or read more than just a moment of the news these days to see that the world is still, despite the coming of the Prince of Peace, filled with war and the victims of war, of refugees and people fleeing violence and conflict, to see disasters both natural and human-made, to find the deep fear and anxiety about the sustainability of God's beloved creation, the creation that provides sustenance for our own survival. And, of course, in our own society and country, we see a growing division, a chasm between people in partisan politics and cultural views that seems to only be growing wider. As people yell at each other across this deepening divide, there are plenty of reasons in the world around us, and I know in many of our own lives this year. Experiences of grief or loss, experiences of disappointment and hopelessness. And so perhaps we've gathered like maybe those shepherds had gathered on that graveyard shift as well, wondering what will be an experience for us of good news, yet alone of great joy. When it seems like there are so many other things going on in the world around us that are drowning out even the possibility of hearing that kind of good news today. Award-winning novelist Catherine Patterson tells the story of a guy named Judson. It, like today, was Christmas Eve when Judson got a call from his sister Fran. She said, "Judson, I'm sorry, but Dad's taken a pretty dramatic turn for the worse. I don't think he's going to make it much longer. You really ought to come now." Judson hesitated, not because he didn't know that he should go, but while he knew his wife would understand, he wasn't sure that his small children would. And yet he got in the car and he drove to the airport. He got a standby ticket, waited for 1, 2, and then 3 flights before he got a seat on a plane flying back across the country to the Midwest farmland where he had grown up so many years earlier. He got out of the plane and got a rental car and began the 50-mile drive to the nursing home where his dad was. His dad had been in decline for several years from dementia, and he guessed maybe that he had had more time than he apparently was going to have. And so as he began that drive, it gave him just enough time to begin to reflect on the moment when things had seemed to go so wrong in their relationship. When Judson was a kid, his older brother Wesley was drafted and sent to Vietnam to fight in the war. And in 1967, his family got a notice from the Red Cross that said that Wesley's plane had been shot down, he'd been captured, and he died in a prison camp. There was something about that detail in particular that Judson knew had crushed his father. The thought that he had not died instantly, but had wasted away in a prison camp. And his dad, whom he had always known to be a joyful and amiable guy, a guy that would bundle up the family and take them to church every Sunday, suddenly became a bitter and resentful man who refused to go to church with the family, even discouraged his wife from taking the kids to church. And so it was a kind of bleak Christmas that year, but the family continued to go to church, and in fact, Judson got a part in the Christmas pageant on Christmas Eve. And so his mom that morning over breakfast had encouraged Dad to come along to church and hear Judson, but Dad stuck with his guns and refused to go. And finally, Judson's mom said, "Well, Judson, why don't you get up and sing the song for your dad? Sing the song that you're going to sing tonight." Judson, nervous and awkward, stood up at the end of the dining room table, and he began. "There's a song in the air. There's a star in the sky. There's a mother's deep prayer. And a low baby's cry. And the star rains its fire where the beautiful sing. For a manger in Bethlehem cradles a king." Judson hadn't even finished the chorus when his father took a deep breath and slammed his fist down on the dining room table, sloshing his coffee. "It's lies!" he yelled. "It's all lies." And he stood up with his eyes flashing like a wild man. He grabbed Judson by the shoulders. He said, "Don't you get how the world really is, boy? There's no angels flapping their wings in the sky. It's all suffering and grief and death. And then he pushed Judson aside and he turned to his wife. Agnes, he said, I don't know how you can believe in all this nonsense. I don't hear any song in the sky, Agnes. All I hear is bombs exploding and people crying. Judson looked over at his mom, who took a deep breath and then quietly said, But Jim, the song is louder. That set him off, and Judson's dad began to swear at his mom in a way that he had never heard before. It scared him. And so he bolted out of the house and out into the night. He began to run across the cornfields through the snow until the cold air in his lungs caught up with him and finally caught him short. He stopped and looked around. He thought, I should just run away from home. But he realized he would die out here. And now he'd gotten himself turned around. He wasn't even sure where he was or how to get home. And so he just started to walk, and in the distance, finally, he saw a little light that he imagined being the porch light of a neighborhood farm. And so he just kept walking steadily, and eventually he discovered it wasn't a porch light at all. It was a flashlight. His dad had come out looking for him. They didn't exchange a single word. They just quietly walked back to the house, and no one in the family ever talked about that moment again. Well, about now, Judson pulled up in front of the nursing home. He got out of the car and walked out across through the lobby, and as he turned into the hallway, he saw his sister standing in the doorway with a tear in her eye. She said, Oh, Judson, I'm so sorry. You're too late, she said. Dad's now unconscious, and they tell me he's not likely to come back. So Judson walked in with his sister, and he took a seat next to his dad's bed and reached out and grabbed his hand. And then his sister said, Judson, the strangest thing happened this afternoon. Dad opened his eyes for a moment. He was alert, clear-eyed in a way that I hadn't seen in years. And he looked at me and said, Franny, tell your brother, the song is louder. Judson nodded, and then he shook his head, and he thought, you know, I'm actually not sure that Dad or even my mom were right. Looking back over the course of my life, I'm not sure the song is always louder. There have been plenty of times when grief and despair have overwhelmed that song. But it is persistent. The song is persistent. It lingers there. It's a song that searches us out somehow, some way, finds us out in the darkness like a flashlight in the night leading us home. It's a song that finds us through the hills and the valleys of our lives that has even eventually caught up with my dear old dad. The song isn't louder, Judson thought to himself, but the song is stronger. And maybe that's God's gift to us tonight on this Christmas Eve. Maybe that's the good news of great joy for us, that the song we sing is stronger. The song we sing is stronger because there is no doubt that the darkness in our lives is real. It's there. And sometimes the fear and anxiety and grief that accompany it have drumbeats that drown out every other possibility of good news, and yet the strong song goes on, regardless of the state of our world or the season of our life. The song is so strong to convince ordinary shepherds and ordinary, broken, fallible us that God, Emmanuel, comes right in to the place where we are now. That God notices and sees us. That God loves us. God has not forgotten this world that God has made. This world that God so loves. The song is more powerful even than the forces that darkness can throw at us, and overwhelms those powers with the disarming power of Christ's grace and love, strength and courage for us all. So tonight, in a moment, we'll light candles together, symbolic lights for us and for all. And together, we'll lift up our voices and remember that the song we sing tonight, the song of good news of great joy, that song always has been and always will be the stronger song. Friends, as you're able, I invite you to rise in body or in spirit, take your candles together, and let us share together the light as we together lift up our voices in song.